KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump signed dozens of executive orders that could reshape many American policies. We'll hear how some of those orders attempt to roll back former President Biden's legacy. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Five years after Ahmaud Arbery was killed, a former prosecutor goes on trial. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The ex-DA is charged with hindering investigations that ultimately led to murder and hate crime convictions for Arbery's killers. Also, why an app that allowed migrants to seek asylum at the border to stop working, and what to make of the last-second preemptive pardons for five members of Joe Biden's family. It's Tuesday, January 21st. Basketball Hall of Famer and Houston Rockets legend Hakeem the Dream Olajuwon is 62 years old. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump has pardoned about 1,500 people convicted of or accused of involvement in the attack on the U.S. Capitol 4 years ago. 140 law enforcement officers were hurt at that time, including those with crushed spinal discs and traumatic brain injuries. Rioters who are imprisoned will be freed. That includes the man who attacked former Washington, D.C. police officer Michael Fanone with a stun gun. Fanone was tased repeatedly, and rioters threatened to murder him with his own gun. Fanone says he later had a mild heart attack. He has strong words about the president's executive action.
I have been betrayed by my country, and I have been betrayed by those that supported Donald Trump.
That audio is courtesy of CNN's Anderson Cooper, AC360. President Trump focused heavily on border security and immigration during his inaugural address. He has declared a national emergency exists on the southern U.S. border. He then signed scores of executive actions on the issues. NPR's Tamara Keith reports Trump is taking aim at one right that is protected by the U.S. Constitution.
Trump is already testing the limits of his executive power, including with an executive order that would end birthright citizenship for the children of people who are not in the country legally or who are in the U.S. lawfully but temporarily.
Birthright. That's a big one.
Birthright citizenship is written into the Constitution, and Trump admitted he doesn't know whether his order will hold up to legal challenge.
It's just absolutely ridiculous, but, you know, we'll see. We have very good grounds.
The order was part of a stack of executive actions signed by Trump in the Oval Office just hours after being sworn in. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The ACLU is filing suit over the birthright issue. President Trump also says the United States will once again consider itself a growing nation that expands its territory. John Otis reports in his inaugural address, Trump has renewed his threat to seize the U.S.-built Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and is a key route for world shipping. It was built and operated by the U.S., but under a treaty signed by both countries in 1977, the canal was handed over to Panama. In his address, Trump insisted that U.S. ships are now being overcharged to use the waterway and claimed, without evidence, that it's controlled by China.
China is operating the Panama Canal, and we didn't give it to China. We gave it to Panama, and we're taking it back.
However, Trump offered no details on how that would happen, and Panama's president, José Raúl Mulino, insisted that the canal belongs to Panama. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
You're listening to NPR. Israel's prime minister says his country's military is conducting a major raid in the occupied West Bank to combat terrorism. Palestinian officials in the West Bank say at least six Palestinians have been killed. This comes as a ceasefire continues to hold in the separate Palestinian enclave of Gaza. A former Georgia prosecutor goes on trial today, charged with interfering in the police investigation of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. He was the black jogger chased and killed by three white men in 2020. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports no arrests were made until months later, and only after video of the crime was leaked. Former Glynn County District Attorney Jackie Johnson is charged with violating her oath of office and hindering a police officer. State prosecutors say she sought to shield Ahmaud Arbery's killers from arrest. One of them had previously worked as an investigator in her office. His father, Marcus Arbery, says it's important to hold the former prosecutor accountable.
To get 100% justice for Ahmaud.
Johnson, who is white, served as the Glynn County DA for 10 years. She has denied interfering and said she immediately recused herself from the Arbery case. Jury selection begins today. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The three men who murdered Arbery are serving life prison sentences. There are blizzard warnings up for parts of Louisiana's Gulf Coast. Up to 4 inches of snow may fall on the region, not far from New Orleans. It's part of a massive winter storm blanketing the southern U.S. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump begins his first full day at the White House today.
So let's catch up because yesterday was a lot. After being sworn in as the 47th president of the United States, he wasted no time undoing President Biden's policies and starting to implement his own, all while using his trademark Sharpie marker.
So this is a big one.
That was the sound of Trump signing one of dozens of executive orders, actions, and proclamations on his first night back in power.
Here with us to break down all that's already happened in the Trump presidency is White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Good morning, Franco.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, so you were at the White House as Trump signed these actions in the Oval Office. What really stood out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly it's the pardons of those involved in the riots at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. I mean, he pardoned 1,500 people who were involved, a really big number. I mean, he also signed a series of orders on immigration. He took a big step toward his own stated goal of overhauling the federal government. Doing so, he signed an order reclassifying tens of thousands of career civil servants so that they can be easily replaced with basically loyalists who are more willing to carry out his agenda. I'll just note that's likely to face legal challenges.
Okay, so not even a full day in office, and he's signing all these orders, including things, as you point out, that will likely be contested in court. Why the hurry? What's the message here?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, it's a full-scale assault on President Biden's legacy. Trump revoked nearly 80 executive actions taken by the Biden administration on issues like climate, energy, and diversity programs. On the other, it's a sign of how Trump plans to expand his presidential powers. I mean, a number of these orders will be challenged in the courts, like you said, but Trump and his team just do not seem to care. I mean, they've made it very clear they're willing to be creative when interpreting and applying these old laws in new ways to fulfill his agenda. It also shows how Trump is willing to get back at people who he feels wronged him. I mean, just as an example, one executive order, there was a measure revoking the security clearance of his former national security advisor, John Bolton. Bolton, of course, wrote a book that Trump was unfit to be president.
Were his orders and actions generally focused on domestic issues overall?
I mean, it was kind of a mix of domestic and foreign, a long list. And as he signed, he actually took questions from reporters who were in the pool in the room about his plans to do in office. I mean, one of them asked when he'll talk to Russian President Vladimir Putin about the war in Ukraine. Here's what Trump said.
I have to speak to President Putin. We're going to have to find out. He can't be thrilled. He's not doing so well. I mean, he's grinding it out, but most people thought that war would have been over in about 1 week. And now you're into 3 years, right? So he can't be thrilled. It's not making him look very good.
So we'll be watching to see when some of these calls with Putin and other foreign leaders start to take place.
Okay, so that all happened like in hours, not even a full day in office. So today is actually his first full day in office. What should we expect?
I mean, he's already busy. You know, he posted on social media this morning that he was removing more than 1,000 of Biden administration appointees, like celebrity chef Jose Andres and retired General Mark Milley. And my colleague Deidre Walsh confirmed that House Speaker Mike Johnson is planning to come to the White House today. But really, beyond that, we don't know much more.
NPR's Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you, Layla.
During the campaign, President Trump often promised mass deportation as part of his plan to overhaul immigration policy. Here are some of the president's first words after taking the oath of office at the U.S. Capitol.
All illegal entry will immediately be halted, and we will begin the process of returning millions and millions of criminal aliens back to the places from which they came.
Stories in multiple news outlets said Chicago would be targeted first, with raids happening as soon as today. Although the man Trump calls his border czar, Tom Homan, told the Washington Post those plans were being reconsidered. So let's bring in Brandon Johnson in on this. He's the mayor of Chicago. Mayor, do you know why Chicago would have been singled out?
Well, good morning. First of all, I'm grateful that the city of Chicago has an incredible love story, a history that our city is very proud of, a city that has been established by a Black Haitian immigrant as well as a Potawatomi woman. And it's a city that has been built by, again, immigrants, migrants, asylum seekers, indigenous people, descendants of slaves. As the mayor of the city of Chicago, I reaffirmed our commitment to being a sanctuary city, also pledging to defend the Illinois Trust Act as a sanctuary state to ensure that all residents' rights are protected. And we are serving the interests of working people every single day in this beloved city.
Yeah, and that Illinois Trust Act that prohibits law enforcement from participating with federal immigration enforcement. But Mayor, I mean, why your city in particular, do you think? Why do you think that's the city of all the cities, Los Angeles, a sanctuary city as well, of all the cities, why Chicago, you think?
Well, I certainly won't speculate what goes through the mind of the President Trump. What I can say is, though, that the reason why I believe that the people I have see Chicago as the global capital of the world is because we have one of the most diverse economies. We have a great education system, university system. And again, many people don't know this, but 20% of the world's fresh water is right in our front yard along Lake Michigan and the St. Lawrence River. We're building affordable homes here, and as we continue to invest in people, we're seeing a decline in every single category of violence. But what I can assure the people of Chicago and the people of America, just like what we're doing in Chicago, it's the cities that essentially run America. And what cities are calling for, I just left D.C. a couple of days ago, the U.S. Conference of Mayors. They want to build more affordable homes. They want to create more job and economic opportunities. They want youth employment and workforce development. They want a better behavior and mental health care. That's what I'm focused in on as mayor of the city of Chicago. And I know that's what mayors are focusing on across this country.
Now, how is Chicago then preparing for the possibility that mass deportation raids could begin as soon as today?
Well, as stated again, as a welcoming city and as a sanctuary city, we are firm in that our police department will not intervene or participate in any way as federal agents. None of our sister agencies or our city departments will cooperate or intervene in any way or any shape or any form.
But can you stop? Can you stop ICE, Immigration,
well,
Customs?
Well, you know, look, they're a federal agent. I mean, there's, you know, if they come in with warrants, if they come in with their authority, we won't, again, intervene or support in any way. But what I can say is that we have worked with community-based organizations as well as other stakeholders so that the people of Chicago know their rights. And that's the part that's most important here. People can continue to go to work, they can go to school, they can use our public facilities without the fear of local police departments giving access to these federal agents to disrupt the flow and what we're doing in Chicago.
Mayor, I know that you released guidelines on how to handle visits from ICE should they enter city property. One thing in particular caught my eye. It read that city employees are not to consent to ICE entering any private or sensitive locations. What are private and sensitive locations?
Well, thank you for that question. There are a number of locations that could fit that criteria. We know that many of our new arrivals and undocumented families rely upon the faith community and other community-based organizations. They seek health care. They seek access to child care. We're assuring the people of this city that we're going to protect their rights. And that's what I've been charged to do as mayor of Chicago. And that includes education rights, as the president has made it very clear. He doesn't believe in public accommodations. He wants to shut down the Department of Education. He doesn't believe in climate change. All rights that the people of Chicago deserve. As mayor of the city of Chicago, I'm going to protect those. Whether you're undocumented, whether you are seeking asylum, or whether you're seeking a good paying job, we're going to fight and stand up for working people. That's what Chicago is known for, and we're going to continue to do that regardless of who's in the White House.
But does that thing, not consenting, what is stated there, does that mean you would try to stop ICE by not consenting? Is it fair to interpret that?
Well, the law that we have passed in the city of Chicago, our welcoming city ordinance, as well as the Illinois Trust Act, gives us the authority to ensure that in sensitive places and public accommodations, that there are rights that these individuals have, and we're going to make sure we protect those rights.
Wondering if you've spoken to other mayors, maybe comparing notes on how to go forward on this.
I have. I've had a great conversation with several mayors. As I said, I was just in D.C. with the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and I've spoken to the mayor of Denver, spoken to the mayor of Atlanta. There are certainly mayors who live in red states who understand that their economy is moved by undocumented individuals. And whether you are in St. Louis, whether you're in Kansas City or Baltimore or anywhere else in this country, the contributions that undocumented families and immigrant families have provided to our economy is one that is quite clear, right? And so what we're simply saying here in Chicago is that there are rights that are provided under our welcoming city ordinance as well as the Illinois Trust Act, and that's a good thing. This goes back to the first black mayor in the history of Chicago, Mayor Harold Washington, who understood that assignment then, and we certainly understand our assignment now.
Mayor, quickly, about 30 seconds, if these raids were to focus on people with criminal convictions, would you support that?
Well, again, those individuals would be subject to the law. So and the federal law provides that type of investigation. Remember, this has happened under previous administrations, whether it's President Obama or President Biden. This is not anything new. I think what the president is attempting to do is create hyperbolic fear and tension in this country, and that's not what we need right now. We need someone who's going to be committed to standing up for working people. That's what I'm doing in Chicago, building more affordable homes, creating opportunities for our young people, providing more access to health care, particularly behavior and mental health care, and all of those investments have driven crime down in our city. That's how we build a better, stronger city, and that's how we provide a more inclusive economy. That's what this president should be focusing in on in this moment.
That is the mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson. Mayor, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Jesse Eisenberg joins us to talk about writing, directing, and starring in the film A Real Pain. He and Kieran Culkin play cousins on a Jewish heritage tour in Poland, which includes a stop at the Majdanek death camp. We'll talk about how the story relates to Eisenberg's life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Something unusual is happening in a Georgia courtroom today. A former county prosecutor goes on trial. She's charged with interfering with the police investigation of Ahmaud Arbery's murder. He was the black jogger chased and killed by three white men in 2020. No arrests were made until months later and only after video of the crime came out. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
It's been nearly 5 years since Ahmaud Arbery was shot to death in Satilla Shores, a subdivision on the Georgia coast near Brunswick.
911, what's the address of your emergency?
I'm out here at Satilla Shores. There's a black male running down the street.
Neighbors, Greg McMichael, his son Travis, and William Roddy Bryan mistakenly assumed Arbery was a thief. They cornered him with pickup trucks before Travis McMichael killed him with three shotgun blasts. The men are all serving life prison sentences for murder and hate crimes. Now another piece of this high-profile racial justice case is coming to court after years of legal delays. Former Glynn County District Attorney Jackie Johnson is charged with violating her oath of office and hindering a police officer. State prosecutors say she sought to shield the McMichaels from arrest. Greg McMichael had previously worked as an investigator in her office and was a former police officer. Arbery's family is ready to see this corruption case come to trial.
You get 100% justice for Ahmaud?
That's his father, Marcus Arbery. He says holding the former prosecutor accountable is no less important than convicting the murderers, because elected officials are supposed to serve everyone equally.
Because these are people we put our lives in hand, that's supposed to serve all people equal in justice. It was just hurtful. You get in these powerful spots like that and don't do their job, it's hurtful.
Johnson, who is white, had served as the Glynn County DA for 10 years. She has denied interfering and said she immediately recused herself from the Arbery case. Her lawyer declined NPR's request for an interview, but in May of 2020, she spoke on WIFO radio on the local Butch and Bob show. They asked her about allegations. She advised the police not to arrest the McMichaels.
That's so far from the truth. It's just a straight up lie.
Some of the evidence state prosecutors are expected to present at her trial include logs of some 16 calls between phones belonging to Greg McMichael and Johnson in the days and weeks after Arbery was killed. There's also this message left on her cell phone shortly after the shooting.
Jackie, this is Greg. Can you call me as soon as you possibly can? My friend and I have been involved in a shooting, and I need some advice right away. If you can please call me.
Community activists have been critical of how Glynn County officials originally handled the case. Arbery was shot to death on February 23rd, but nothing happened until graphic cell phone video of the killing, recorded by Brian, was leaked on May 5th. The video sparked public outrage, and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation took over the case from Glynn County Police. Under mounting pressure, the McMichaels and Brian were arrested not long after. In Brunswick, the nearly three-month delay in seeking justice for Arbery sparked a grassroots movement to transform the community. Elijah Bobby Henderson is co-founder of A Better Glynn, a civic engagement coalition founded after Arbery's murder.
We understood that bringing light to his case was not enough.
The group set out to drive up voter turnout and work to make sure that Jackie Johnson was defeated in her re-election as DA. But Henderson says they have bigger goals that will take time.
We want better systems. We want better outcomes. Make improvements to the systems that it failed on that day and that have historically failed in Glynn County.
Henderson says he's hopeful the evidence in this trial can shed light on the local power structure.
I call it a cabal. We know that there's handshake deals and backroom conversations that happen, but that was bad, right? If a Sunday jogger can have his life snuffed out and they are intent to cover it up, you know, we are returning to the place where people are lynched without justice.
Arbery's murder was among those that sparked a national racial justice outcry in 2020. Barbara Arnwine of the Transformative Justice Coalition says if the allegations against the former DA are proven in court, it will underscore inequities in the criminal justice system.
These vigilantes that took justice into their own hands, bad enough, but to have the assistance after the fact of a prosecutor is very distressing.
Arnwine says the trial is an opportunity for transparency about what exactly happened in those first few weeks when the family feared there would be no justice for their son's killing.
It was very tough, you know, those weeks that the family didn't see an active investigation, but were being told that the best was being done when it wasn't.
The Georgia Attorney General's office will be prosecuting the Johnson case, with jury selection set to start today. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Brunswick, Georgia.
On this first full day of a new administration, we're covering President Trump's many executive actions. He pardoned 1,500 people involved in the January 6th attack on the Capitol. He reclassified tens of thousands of career civil servants to make it easier to fire and replace them. He signed a series of orders on immigration, including one that seeks to end birthright citizenship, which immediately drew a legal challenge. And he declared a national energy emergency.
We're analyzing many of these actions and a lot more throughout today's show, and we'll continue doing so in the days and weeks to come. So stay connected by listening live on the NPR app or your local station.
This is NPR News.
President Donald Trump has returned to power as the nation's 47th president. He promises a raft of policies targeting immigration, gender, energy, and more. I'm Elsa Chang. Join us as we unpack Trump's first full day in office on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Among the slew of executive orders and actions that President Trump has signed off on to jumpstart his new administration is one that declares a national emergency at the southern U.S. border. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports that Trump wants additional funding and resources for border security.
President Trump's executive order calls for the deployment of armed forces, including the National Guard, to the southern border. The order says it's needed to obtain, quote, complete operational control of the southern border of the United States. Trump is also asking the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security to continue building barriers at the border and to secure detention space and transportation for the immigration enforcement operations. It's important to note that Trump is inheriting a relatively quiet border. Although it's true that unauthorized crossings hit an all-time high in 2023 during the Biden administration, that number has sharply dropped to COVID-era figures, in part due to Biden's asylum restrictions at the border. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Washington.
The Gulf Coast is seeing an unusual snowstorm. The storm has led to the first blizzard warning for southeast Texas and southwest Louisiana. Governors in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia have declared states of emergency as much of the eastern U.S. contends with bitterly cold temperatures. This is NPR News. Israel's top general says he will step down in March. Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi announced his resignation today, citing failures to stop Hamas's October 7th attack. His resignation comes amid the ceasefire in Gaza that has seen more than 1,500 humanitarian aid trucks roll in. As President Trump starts his second term, French President Emmanuel Macron is calling on Europe to spend more on defense. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports that Macron calls the war in Ukraine an opportunity for a European strategic wake-up call.
President Macron is focusing attention on expected changes in Washington's foreign policy, especially regarding the war in Ukraine. Trump has criticized the cost of the war in Ukraine for U.S. taxpayers and vowed to bring the conflict to a swift end. He said he wants to shift more of the burden of Ukraine onto Europe. Macron asked, "What will we do in Europe tomorrow if our American ally withdraws its warships from the Mediterranean, if they send their fighter jets from the Atlantic to the Pacific?" Macron warned that Russia's war on Ukraine would not end tomorrow or the day after, and said Europe must be ready. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
There's been an upset at the first Grand Slam tennis tournament of the year. American Coco Gauff has been knocked out of the Australian Open, losing a quarterfinal match to Spain's Paula Badosa. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. In his final hours as president, Joe Biden issued preemptive pardons for five family members, his siblings, and their spouses. Now, in a statement yesterday, Biden said his family had faced partisan attacks and threats, and he had, quote, no reason to believe these attacks will end. Kim Whaley's now back on the show. She's the author of Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. Kim, what did you make of those last-minute announcements?
I think they were both surprising and somewhat disappointing. Of course, there was controversy over Joe Biden's pardoning of his son, Hunter, but that was after years of investigation, both under Donald Trump's Department of Justice and with a special counsel, produced two criminal trials, a guilty plea, as well as a jury verdict. These are sort of open-ended, nebulous pardons for unidentified conduct, and it really smacks of nepotism and favoritism when you really have, we have thousands of pardon applicants that were turned down, presumably moving into the Trump administration.
Kim, I'm going to go back to the title of your book, which is How the Pardon System Works. I mean, is what we've seen, is that how it's supposed to work or just how it's allowed to work?
It's how it's allowed to work, although I argue in the book these kinds of shady pardons really began probably with George H.W. Bush and the Iran-Contra pardon. Some believe that was to silence witnesses who could testify potentially against the president. And then we saw controversial pardons with Bill Clinton, really mushroomed with Donald Trump's first administration. But I think some are surprised that Joe Biden would take this kind of step at the very waning moments, really, of his presidency.
And how might Biden's decision affect maybe how President Trump or future presidents beyond Trump might use that pardon power?
Well, even before this, you know, I traced the question back to Trump versus U.S. when the Supreme Court manufactured criminal immunity in response to January 6th and Trump's alleged wrongdoing. The pardon power allows presidents to essentially pardon accomplices in crimes in the White House now that they have immunity and create, you know, this big crime spree where people get off doing the bidding of the president so long as they're pardoned. And I think if Donald Trump or others were going to do it moving forward, Joe Biden has set a precedent for really these open-ended pardons that we have never really seen in to this extreme prior to yesterday.
And just to be clear, can a president pardon themselves?
I argue no, but again, immunity makes self-pardons irrelevant. If you can't be prosecuted for a crime that you commit using the massive power of the office, there's no need to pardon anything because you're already immune.
Now, should the rules around pardons need reform? I mean, that power comes from the Constitution, so would it be like moving a mountain?
It would be. To amend it, especially after the court called it core power, would require a constitutional amendment, which is quite laborious and almost impossible these days.
So quite the big mountain, then.
Right. Although Congress could try to amend the Freedom of Information Act and require some transparency, and that's unclear if the court would even uphold that much of a limit on the pardon power.
All right. So let's assume for the sake of argument here that it can be moved, the mountain can be moved. If the reform happens, should it be wide or narrow?
I argue that it's the time has come for no more pardon power because it's benefiting the wealth and people with wealth and power, just like the criminal justice system. But at a minimum, an amendment to stop these last minute pardons, stop them prior to the election day, that would put some pressure on outgoing presidents maybe to rein in these controversial pardons.
Consider you just said that there should be no more pardon power. Are you leaning more toward wide or more like narrow reform?
Yeah, wide reform.
Wide, okay.
You know, there's an argument that, and this goes dates back to the Enlightenment, pre-constitutional, that the pardon power not only incentivizes people to commit crimes, but it also disincentivizes Congress to clean up the criminal justice system. The idea being, well, you can always ask for a pardon. And that just seems like unfairness all the way around.
Kim Whaley is a law professor and the author of a book on the president's pardon power. Kim, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Let's move now from the 46th president's final actions to the 47th president's first moves. Within minutes of Donald Trump being sworn into office, he stopped an app that allowed migrants to get appointments at the border to seek asylum in the U.S. As NPR's Ada Peralta reports from the border city of Juarez, it left migrants in Mexico facing despair.
As President Trump was arriving at the Capitol in Washington, Clidel Jimenez couldn't keep still. His nervousness meant he kept rubbing his shoulders with his hands. He lined up at 5 a.m. here at the foot of the international bridge that leads to El Paso. When he arrived in Mexico City from Cuba 3 months ago, he started applying for appointments. And on the first day of January, he got a 1 p.m. appointment on January 20th.
Hay que esperar.
We just have to wait and see, he says. He looks at his wife cradling their one-month-old. I ask him, is she letting you sleep? and he smiles. She doesn't sleep at all, he says, but that's okay. She wakes up at night, and she smiles at you and wants to play. We're in such a precarious place. Seeing her smile is the only thing that keeps us going. But as we speak, phones start lighting up. Margelis Tinoco, a Venezuelan migrant, drops to her knees. God, why me? She sobs. The CBP One app on her phone says her appointment was no longer valid. She had been waiting for that appointment every day for 6 months. Lord, have mercy on me, she said. Lord, have mercy on my family. President Biden, who introduced the app, made it nearly impossible to ask for asylum at the border without it. The app became like a lottery for migrants. So its demise shook this border city. Migrants walked across the town in a daze. Angela Ayala had been waiting for an appointment since she left Venezuela nearly a year ago. The economic situation forced me to leave. Then she thought back on what she had to feed her kids. We had to split an egg. This trip was supposed to help them. Along the way, she says she's been beaten and sexually assaulted, but she kept going. With what's happened, I've lost hope. She understands that President Trump has to protect his country, but she hopes he finds compassion. He should know, she says, that we're not all bad. Eder Peralta, NPR News, Juarez, Mexico.
This is NPR News. President Trump's inaugural address described an America in failure. He said God meant for him to save it. What will day two bring? Next time, here and now.
Our phones hold a lot of stuff, right? Grocery lists, music, pet photos. They also help us stay informed. Listen live on this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, I'm A. Martinez. When sub-zero temperatures strike, most people wrap themselves in a blanket and avoid leaving home. Not if you're a proud citizen of the land of 10,000 lakes. That's because this past Saturday, thousands of Minnesotans ventured out into an art festival on a frozen lake. The event features displays like a knitting pavilion where guests have to weave yarn into panels to make the roof and the walls of a shanty, and also Cat World, where a witch transforms you into a cat. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. A public radio investigation has found that schools in the Midwest are struggling to serve students who experience housing instability. That's despite a federal law and federal funding intended to ensure equal access to education for homeless K through 12 students. Kayvon Mansouri joins us now from St. Louis to tell us about this investigation. He's a reporter for the Midwest Newsroom. That's a collaboration between public radio stations and NPR. So let's start with an overview of what you found.
Well, for the last year, we examined the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act and how that federal law really falls short. It's supposed to help school districts find ways to assist homeless kids, but among other things, we found the amount of funding is stretched paper thin nationwide, and how school districts go about identifying students who need support is a struggle in its own right. Our investigation covered Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska, and the picture is similar in other states.
Okay, so why has that been a challenge?
Well, because school districts vastly undercount students who are homeless, meaning thousands of are missing out on support they need to succeed.
Okay, maybe an undercount, but what if a school district knows they have a number of students who need services? I mean, do they get the funding they need under this federal law?
Not always. Even when school districts know that they have students who need support, they have to go through a competitive grant process to actually receive McKinney-Vento funding. And that's where smaller rural schools really struggle because they often don't have the personnel or expertise to compete for that money. In fact, we found that in the states we looked at, fewer than 5% of the K through 12 school districts actually receive any McKinney-Vento funding. The amount of money available is really low. There's only $129 million annually for more than 4,900 school districts nationwide. On top of that, competition for the money is fierce.
That money, what does that money actually pay for?
So most notably, a free ride to and from school and academic support, which are pillars of the McKinney-Vento Act. Students struggling with housing often miss a lot of school due to lack of transportation. That's made worse in rural areas where your school might be 10 miles away. So consistent transportation and academic health when they miss school is a big part of that. But as I noted, that's not happening in many rural areas we examined.
Why not?
It's complex, but the core issue is visibility and training. The smaller school district is, the less likely they are to have the resources and know-how to identify a student who's struggling with housing. Barbara Duffield runs a nonprofit organization called Schoolhouse Connection. Helps school districts in the states better connect to improve the likelihood students get those services.
The challenge is almost circular. You don't see the students, so you don't think that they're there, so you don't set aside enough funding to have the capacity to go out and find the students.
And the people in charge of identifying that a student needs aid at smaller schools often are wearing many hats. One state official told us about an assistant superintendent in charge of identifying McKinney-Vento eligible students while he drove a bus, worked the lunch line, and mopped the floors.
Wow, that's tough. Anything being done to help improve this system?
There's bipartisan support to increase funding for homeless education, but little actual movement. Through the American Rescue Plan Act, Congress made about $800 million in federal funds available to school districts across the country to aid homeless students. But again, my recent reporting shows school districts struggled to obtain and spend that money nationwide. And since millions of dollars went unspent, it's likely to be returned to the U.S. Treasury.
Quickly, you mentioned bipartisan support. What does that look like?
Several members of Congress have signed a letter that basically says that more money needs to go towards this, but it's not much movement's been made to increase the actual budget for this in the past several years.
Kayvon Mansouri reports for the Midwest Newsroom. That's a collaboration between public radio stations and NPR. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Our next guest is interested in the ways organized crime has influenced American presidents as far back as Franklin Roosevelt. Eric Dezenhall is the author of Wise Guys and the White House, Gangsters, Presidents, and the Deals They Made. He spoke with Steve Inskeep about his latest book and the root of his fascination with the mob.
Well, I grew up around it. I grew up in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, a few miles outside of Philadelphia. It was impossible in my neighborhood not to have a relative, a neighbor, a family friend, a Little League coach who was involved with it. And it took on a larger proportion when I saw that people, you weren't allowed to talk about it. And why is that? And then The Godfather came out when I was 10 years old, and it turned out that the character Johnny Fontaine, the Sinatra character, played by Al Martino lived right around the corner. So we thought we were at the center of it all, but yet you couldn't talk about it. And I set about the adventure that lasted decades of trying to figure out who exactly these characters are and who they aren't, which is just as important.
Oh, you touch on an interesting part here. Because there are so many legends and because it is supposed to be secretive, it is hard to tell, isn't it, sometimes if someone is a serious mobster or just a small-time crook or just somebody that stories are told about.
Well, on any given day, you could stand on the boardwalk and listen to somebody with a toothpick in their mouth making a reference to being able to have things taken care of. One of the things I have found with investigating this and writing this over the years is everybody has a story about why all of this is personally relevant to them. In fact, I find that when I give a book talk, nobody really asks me a question. What they really want to do is they want to tell you about their tie to all of this.
Who's a president that, in your estimation, was very close to the mob?
I think that the most mob-relevant president was Harry Truman, in the sense that he was hand-selected by a mafia-controlled machine.
I guess we should pause to explain to people, Truman comes from Missouri. He was supported by the Kansas City Democratic political machine and brought up through that machine, and he was kind of the clean face in front of this corrupt political machine. This is what you're saying was a mob-connected group.
Now, here's the irony. There's no evidence that Harry Truman ever took a dime, and I don't think that he did. I think that if you look at what he wrote in his diaries and what he said privately, is there were certain people I had to deal with. I think what makes Truman different than someone like Donald Trump is Donald Trump has been unique in that he doesn't run away from it at all. And regrettably, I have to conclude when I looked at how he dealt with the mob that he may actually be right. The way he dealt with the mob was smart because none of it was provably illegal.
Well, you document in the book how his father and then Trump were in New York real estate, which is, if you're talking about the construction industry, if you're talking about unions, you're talking about mob ties in New York.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that kept coming back to me in this book over and over again was that the people who knew how to use the mobsters were, in the long run, more clever and benefited more than the mobsters themselves, who were still criminals. This was true of Joe Kennedy as well. Joe Kennedy,
JFK's father, right?
JFK's father. You always hear that he was a bootlegger. He was not a bootlegger. He was in the liquor business, and he was in the liquor business legally. Joe Kennedy consistently knew how to do things technically, legally, that today we tend to view as illegal, such as insider trading, which is illegal now. Joe Kennedy did it in a way that was at that time legal.
What's the connection, if any, between this lifelong fascination of yours and your day job running a very well-known crisis communications firm?
What the two things have in common is that I spent my career being lied to. And for the record, I'm retired from day-to-day activity at my firm, but being in the crisis management business, I have been lied to day in and day out from morning, noon, and night. And when you sit down with people from the mob world or the spy world, which I also write about, I'm lied to. And so what I've had to learn to do is to listen to the lies because they tell me the truth at some level. And one of the most interesting things about this to me is how many of these mobsters wanted to be seen as legitimate. They wanted to be seen as Americans. In fact, you know, Meyer Lansky got involved with the World War II program to secure the docks around the port of New York to protect it from Nazi sabotage after he had tried to enlist in the U.S. Army to fight the Nazis, but was rejected because of his age. He was 40, and his size, he was only 5'4". But he desperately wanted to be seen as a patriotic American. And one of the reasons I had access to his thinking and his notes and his records is because he very much wanted the story out about what he did during World War II to fight the Nazis.
Have you represented someone whose problem was they were accused of mafia ties?
No. I have, I always stuck in my business in the corporate world. I did not want to be anywhere near anyone associated with that and turned that down. In fact, I've, on several occasions, I worked with companies that had been targeted by organized crime, and we actually had to work with the FBI and the Justice Department to get the mob off the back of a corporate client. But no, I'm actually, despite what I write about, I'm very timid about being anywhere close to that.
Eric Desenhall is the author of Wise Guys and the White House, Gangsters, Presidents, and the Deals They Made. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
My little buckaroo, while the light of western skies is shining down on you, don't you know it's time for bed, another day is through, so go to sleep, my little buckaroo. Don't you realize, my little buckaroo,